Good evening. We talk about the town halls, the new study on therapeutics, and what the flu has in store for COVID-19, while New York City tenants face the end of a moratorium. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, October 16th, 2020. President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden held competing televised town hall events last night instead of the second debate that had been scheduled before Trump became ill with the coronavirus. Eileen Alfandary reports.
NBC host Savannah Guthrie pushed Trump on misinformation and conspiracy theories he has peddled. At the Miami town hall, Trump was asked if his opinion about mask wearing has changed since he contracted the coronavirus. Trump said he was fine with people wearing masks and then misstated a study on their efficacy.
But just the other day, they came out with a statement that 85% of the people that wear masks catch it. Well, so, you know,
they
this
didn't
is
say
a
that.
Very
I know that study.
Well, that's what I heard and that's what I saw.
What the study actually found was that 85% of a small group of COVID-19 patients surveyed reported they had worn a mask often or always around the time they would have become infected. They were twice as likely to have eaten in a restaurant. Trump refused to disavow the QAnon conspiracy that says Democrats are a pedophile satanic ring and that Trump is the savior.
I know nothing about QAnon.
I just told you.
I know very little. You told me, but what you tell me doesn't necessarily make it fact. I hate to say that.
There's not a satanic pedophile.
I have no idea. I know nothing about
that. You don't know that?
Trump did disavow white supremacy, and he seemingly admitted he owed $400 million in debt, but called it a very small percentage of his overall wealth. He wouldn't say whether he had tested negative on the day of his first debate with Biden on September 29th, allowing only possibly I did, possibly I didn't. At his town hall meeting, Biden denounced the White House handling of the coronavirus and mask wearing while COVID-19 has claimed more than 217,000 lives in this country.
The words of a president matter.
Absolutely.
No matter whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, they matter. And when a president doesn't wear a mask or makes fun of folks like me when I was wearing a mask for a long time, then, you know, people say, well, it mustn't be that important.
When pressed by ABC's George Stephanopoulos, Biden said he would announce before Election Day whether he'll support expanding the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court if Democrats win the presidency and the Senate.
You know, you said so many times during the campaign, all through the course of your career, it's important to level with
the
American people.
But George, if I say, no matter what answer I gave you, if I say it, that's the headline tomorrow. It won't be about what's going on now, the improper way they're proceeding.
But don't voters have a right to know where you
stand?
They
do have a right to know where I stand, and I'll have a right to know where I stand before they vote.
So you'll come out with a clear position before Election Day?
Yes.
Biden said he plans to participate in next week's second and final presidential debate, but that he would ask Trump to take a COVID-19 test before arriving. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
And Republican mega donor Sheldon Adelson and his wife have given $75 million to a new PAC attacking Joe Biden. The investment was made amid Republican concerns that President Trump's campaign is flailing and might not be able to correct course. The Preserve America PAC is run by Chris LaCivita. He's a strategist behind the 2004 Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign, which helped tank then-Democratic nominee John Kerry's bid with misleading ads which questioned Kerry's record in the Vietnam War. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports the Trump White House has installed two political operatives at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to try and control the information it releases about the coronavirus pandemic. The two appointees assigned to the CDC's Atlanta headquarters arrived in June. They have no public health background. The two have reportedly been tasked with keeping an eye on Dr. Robert Redfield, the agency's director, as well as scientists at the nation's premier health agency. One of the White House appointees became acting chief of staff to Redfield. The other began sitting in on scientific meetings. And the World Health Organization said on Friday it would assess monoclonal antibodies and other antiviral drugs in its trial of potential COVID-19 treatments. That comes after interim findings of a worldwide drug trial found Gilead Sciences' remdesivir had no impact on survival rates. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said its solidarity trial would continue after it was launched in March in 500 hospitals in 30 countries to assess the efficacy of remdesivir and several other drugs in patients with COVID-19.
6 months ago, WHO launched the solidarity trial to evaluate the effectiveness of four drugs for the treatment of COVID-19. The Solidarity Trial is the world's largest randomized controlled trial of COVID-19 therapeutics, involving almost 13,000 patients in 500 hospitals in 30 countries. In June, we announced that we were discontinuing the hydroxychloroquine arm of the study, and in July, we announced that we could no longer enroll patients to receive the combination of lopinavir and ritonavir. Interim results from the trial now show that the other two drugs in the trial, remdesivir and interferon, have little or no effect in preventing death from COVID-19 or reducing time in hospital. We expect the full results to be published shortly in a leading scientific journal. We would like to thank all of the patients and clinicians who participated so far in this unprecedented study, and the countries and hospitals who covered the costs of the trial. The Solidarity Trial is still recruiting about 2,000 patients every month and will assess other treatments, including monoclonal antibodies and new antivirals. For the moment, the corticosteroid dexamethasone is still the only therapeutic shown to be effective against COVID-19 for patients with severe disease. There are still many other ongoing trials of therapeutics identified through the research and development roadmap for COVID-19.
Dexamethasone is a drug that was given to President Trump along with monoclonal antibodies when he tested positive for COVID earlier this month. Dr. Adnan also sounded a warning on expected co-infections during the winter of both COVID and influenza. There are normally 3.5 million flu cases worldwide, and winter means the Northern Hemisphere is next in line to see a rise in flu cases.
As the Northern Hemisphere winter approaches, cases of COVID-19 are rising globally, especially in Europe, where countries are expanding measures to contain it, and many people are understandably wary of the disruption the pandemic is causing to their lives and livelihoods. Last week, the number of cases reported in Europe was almost three times higher than during the first peak in March. Although the number of deaths reported in Europe last week is much lower than in March, hospitalizations are increasing and many cities are reporting they will reach their intensive care bed capacity in the coming weeks. Every hospital bed occupied by a patient with COVID-19 is a bed that's unavailable for someone else with another condition or disease, such as influenza. Every year, there are up to 3.5 million severe cases of seasonal influenza worldwide and up to 650,000 respiratory-related diseases. During this year's Southern Hemisphere winter, the number of seasonal flu cases and deaths was less than usual because of the measures put in place to contain COVID-19. But we cannot assume the same will be true in the Northern Hemisphere flu season. The co-circulation of influenza and COVID-19 may present challenges for health systems and health facilities, since both diseases present with many similar symptoms.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom is Director General of the World Health Organization. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In New York City, public advocate Jumaane Williams introduced two new bills increasing fines against landlords who don't fix building code violations. The bills would force landlords to address the problem within 48 hours. One of Williams' bills would require the Department of Housing Preservation and Development to maintain certification of correction watch lists to ensure the violations are corrected. The bill could impose fines of up to $2,500 a day for violations or for falsely reporting that the violations had been fixed. The second bill would require HPD to respond to complaints almost immediately. Meanwhile, a group of people living near the site of a Radisson hotel where the city plans to move 235 homeless men are suing to stop the move, potentially delaying their transfer from a hotel on the Upper West Side. Downtown New Yorkers Incorporated say in the suit that the city doesn't have a contract to move the men and said it's being done in a fundamentally flawed process unrelated to the COVID-19 emergency. The men were moved into the Lucerne Hotel on West 79th Street in late July, and their arrival caused a political stir. More than 15,000 people joined a Facebook group that opposed the move and said the men were disrupting the neighborhood. But a counter-movement urged the city to keep the men there. Mayor de Blasio decided last month that they needed to go, but the move has been delayed since. On Sunday, there were tense moments at Gracie Mansion as protesters fighting for the homeless started shaking barricades. They were trying to bypass police to deliver what they called an eviction letter to Mayor Bill de Blasio's front door. It happened hours after a demonstration in front of the Lucerne Hotel, where the 300 men had been staying to safely social distance during the coronavirus pandemic. Many of the protesters were holding signs, with some reading, "Homeless Lives Matter." They say the mayor should make use of vacant hotel rooms to protect homeless New Yorkers from COVID-19. And New Yorkers are fearful that a moratorium preventing evictions since COVID reared its head in New York earlier this year may be coming to an end. Rumors are spreading that Monday, all tenants facing evictions will have to show up at housing court or face losing their cases. Legal Aid Society staff attorney Ellen Davidson says while immediate evictions are not happening in the city, upstate residents are not protected as robustly.
People who are going through eviction cases in New York City have access to legal counsel. Outside of New York City, almost no one does.
If they don't know about what we're talking about right now, that they could go in there blind, not knowing they even have this defense.
Yes, exactly right. And that's why it's not a true eviction moratorium. We've had this division in terms of how courts are looking at cases that were in the process of moving forward on March 17th and those that were filed afterwards. The cases that were filed before March 17th have been moving forward in courts throughout the state since the end of June. No one could get evicted, but everything up until the time of eviction could happen. What happened last week is the courts have now said that all cases can start moving forward, even cases filed after the crisis. And more concerning, that up until this moment, the courts have not punished tenants who didn't show up for their court cases. If you don't appear in your court case, if you miss a court date, you lose. And you get what's called a default judgment, which means the landlord wins because you defaulted. And up until this moment, no one's been defaulted, and that's been the rule in the court's orders. And that will come to an end November 3rd. And after that, people who don't appear, people who don't respond to court papers, will end up losing their cases because of that non-response.
And these were because of COVID, this exception?
Yes, because of COVID, because the courts were concerned that they were some of the most unsafe places in our state for people to spend time. They wanted to move all of their operations virtual, remote. But the problem is most of the tenants who show up in court are low income. Some are very low income and extremely low income. A lot of tenants in New York State don't have access to the technology that would allow them to participate remotely. If they're moving cases forward remotely with landlords and their attorneys and tenants can't participate, there needed to be a plan in place to how to address that problem. The plan they put in place was that people wouldn't get defaulted for prioritizing their health and then not being able to participate remotely. And now the courts are taking the position that people, I guess, need to show up in person in housing court.
We're talking now about a second, even third wave that might even be larger than the last ones. COVID isn't gone yet.
We're starting evictions. People are going to start losing their homes already as we hit the second wave or third wave, whatever we're in. And as we get into winter, where people are going to have to choose about doubling up, living in congregate shelters, or living on the streets or in their cars. It's just the lack of planning, the lack of consideration, the absolute depth of tenants being abandoned throughout the state is astounding.
Sounds like a lot of the criticisms of President Trump are pretty hypocritical. Business comes first, and so what? Let's get back to work.
In this particular instance, there's not a lot of daylight between the federal government and the state government, unfortunately. Those who represent tenants, the tenant movement, have been pretty clear that we blame our state government for this situation.
Anything you'd like to add?
People who in New York City who received court papers since June and who were told by the courts that they didn't need to respond to those papers. And people have been relying on that. Things have changed. People now need to respond to the papers. They need to call the courts in wherever they are if they've put court papers aside and do everything possible before November 3rd to make sure that they are not in default in their cases.
Legal Aid Society staff attorney Ellen Davidson, if all this sounds confusing, don't worry. It is confusing. There are numerous moratoriums coming from federal and state and city authorities, and they all seem to at times contradict each other. Governor Cuomo had passed an executive order, made an executive order to raise a defense, allowing tenants to raise the defense of lack of finances because they've lost their jobs and because there hasn't been the money coming forward from the federal government as it was earlier this year, and therefore are unable to pay their rent. That is actually going to be a defense. You can actually take that into court and say, I can't pay. However, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has their own moratorium, a federal moratorium, that because of the dangers of being evicted and being out in the streets or in congregate shelters while one is being evicted or in court for that matter, it's a public health emergency and they can't be allowed to do that. So until January, under the federal rules, you can't be evicted for that reason. So this is a very confusing and very fluid situation, and tenants who are having a hard time paying their rent or who are in some ways or another unsure of what their status is with their landlords and with their leases should be very careful and remember that in New York City, at least, and not New York State, you do have a right to the city, the government paying for your legal representation in housing court. To talk more about that, we have Columbia University law professor Conrad Johnson, who says tenants shouldn't panic, but the problems of housing and COVID are very real.
The thing I would want your listeners to know is that they shouldn't panic. There are a number of overlapping moratoriums out there that will prevent evictions for most people. Whether or not you get a notice to come to court or not doesn't mean you're going to be evicted. So people shouldn't start fleeing from their homes. And the reason that there are all these moratoriums is because leaving your home in the middle of a pandemic presents a public health crisis for you and for everyone. People should stay put and take advantage of the moratoriums that are out there and the legal services that are available.
And what are those services?
If you're facing eviction and you get some kind of notice that you or could be evicted, you would be entitled to a free attorney from one of 11 different service providers in New York City as a result of a program that was enacted by the city council that is called universal access, or what some are calling a right to counsel in eviction proceedings.
Now, what about upstate New York?
The CDC moratorium would apply to most people who were upstate. And then the Safe Harbor Act, which was enacted by the state legislature and signed by the governor, would also protect folks from evictions. And that has been continued through the governor's order through the end of the year. The Safe Harbor Act protects people in non-payment proceedings, whereas the CDC's moratorium would prevent evictions for people who are the subject of both non-payments and what many people call no-cause holdover proceedings, an eviction proceeding based on the fact that your lease has expired. I'm not saying that everyone is protected, but I am saying that to use the fire alarm analogy, that everyone shouldn't just run from their homes because they feel like they have no shot at protecting themselves.
Because of COVID, a lot of people haven't had their jobs, and we haven't had since the summer any of these enhanced unemployment insurance payments from the state. What about the money?
That's obviously a huge problem. And one of the things that should be happening is that the moratoriums should be coupled with some kind of rent subsidies that would help defray costs and keep people in their homes who have suffered as a result of the things you've just spoken about, unemployment or the loss of roommate or someone else who was helping to pay the rent.
Are we moving hell or high water towards a world where housing is a human right? It's come time to look at housing as something that has to be defended in the same way you have a right to eat and other basic things.
From your mouth to God's ears, the truth of the matter is, one of the things that have come out of the pandemic is the realization that we're all in this together. It was possible, I think, for some people, though unwise, to think that the problems of inequality and poverty only affected people that weren't them or living in their neighborhoods. And the pandemic has shown us that that's patently not true. But it was always not true. Having people in shelters and having people be homeless and leaving affordable housing is something we all ultimately pay for by way of policing costs and health care costs and emergency room visits and loss of education and the like. And so it really is the fact that housing is fundamental to our public welfare. And the sooner that our governments realize that and take measures to protect that, the more safe we'll all be and the more money we'll all save.
Columbia University Law Professor Conrad Johnson. And we focus a lot on New York City and upstate New York, but right across the river is the state of New Jersey, which has its own reality to deal with. In Newark's Ironbound neighborhood on the eastern edge of the city, just covering 4 square miles, but crammed alongside it more than 50,000 residents, are hundreds of contaminated sites, industrial warehouses, a sewage processing facility, and an incinerator that burns trash from as far away as New York City. Filmmaker Julie Winokur, who directed and produced a documentary on the neighborhood's fight for environmental justice called The Sacrifice Zone, a film centering on the women of color leading the fight for environmental justice in the neighborhood, says Newark has been a dumping site for hundreds of years, but she's hopeful that an awake community can make change.
Ironbound is a neighborhood in Newark that basically is bordered by railroad tracks, the airport, the port. If you've ever been through Newark Penn Station, that's where the Ironbound begins. It's a neighborhood that's got over 50,000 people, and it is largely immigrants and African American.
And it has a problem stretching way back of industrial pollution.
The Ironbound, you're talking about at this point centuries worth of pollution that's been going into the waterways there.
What is the effect of that today on the people who live there?
The Ironbound is an environmental justice community. It has the largest Superfund site in the country. There's a factory that used to manufacture dioxin for Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. It's got the Port of Newark. It's got the largest incinerator on the East Coast. It's got a sewage treatment plant, over 200 brownfields, which are known toxic sites. You have a cumulative impact in the neighborhood that is really an overwhelming burden on the people that live there.
And what has the response been in that community?
The level of organization and activism within the Ironbound has really been outstanding. There's the Ironbound Community Corporation, which has really figured out how to bring on legal expertise, scientific expertise, and then organizing at a really stellar level so that they finally have been able to push back on the industrial powers that be. And it's been decades of fighting.
What is the Sacrifice Zone?
The Sacrifice Zone is a half-hour film that we've just recently produced that looks at environmental justice in the Ironbound. We have just aired it on NJTV, but it is now part of the Montclair Film Festival. And it really looks at the fight, the battle that's going on the ground in the Ironbound to push back on multiple polluters. It's just the fight to breathe clean air.
Sacrifice zone implies that they sacrifice this. Can it ever be cleaned up when something is as polluted as what you've just described? Is there really a hope?
Yes, there's hope, because 2 weeks ago in the state of New Jersey, Governor Murphy signed into law the most progressive piece of legislation in the country to fight for environmental justice. What this law says is that the Department of Environmental Protection has to take into account cumulative impacts in a neighborhood before issuing new permits or reissuing existing permits. And so it's the first time in the country that the community actually gets a say at the table when these decisions are made.
Who are the worst offenders? Are there people right now who they have to fight every day?
There are so many offenders in the Ironbound. I think one of the things I'd like to draw attention to, because the film does point out several of the major polluters, the airport, the port, the diesel trucks that pass through the neighborhood, the garbage incinerator. So there are a lot of villains in this story. There are a lot of places to point fingers. But I just want to make it really clear that if we're going to be honest about this, we are the villains, each one of us, who create all the garbage, who buy all the goods that come through the port, who fly in and out of Newark Airport. We have to own this problem as our problem, and that we are culprits in producing an insane amount of waste that has to be cleaned up. I hate to point fingers at any one polluter.
Where people can get in touch with you, or where they can see this film?
It's part of the Montclair Film Festival, which is starting today, and it's running through October 25th. If you visit our website, thesacrificezone.org, you can request a screening of the film. So we're trying to make it available to everyone who's interested.
Anything you'd like to add?
In terms of environmental justice, we all have to be way more proactive in showing up at permit hearings and zoning board hearings. We need to support groups like the Ironbound Community Corporation, and we need to make sure that when we do have laws that are there to protect these communities, that we get out and make our voices heard so that the regulations actually go to work and they do the job they're supposed to do.
Filmmaker Julie Winokur, who directed and produced a documentary on Newark's Ironbound neighborhood's fight for environmental justice called The Sacrifice Zone. The film centers on the women of color leading the fight for environmental justice. And that's some of the news for Friday, October 16th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.